I'm Nick Dearden, and this is Counterpower, the podcast for global solidarity. 8 out of 10 of the richest men in the world have made their fortune from big tech empires. Perhaps that's unsurprising, given that big tech corporations are some of the most profitable companies in the world. In fact, virtually all of the gains on the US stock market last year were related to AI. The big tech giants are the robber barons of our age. Like their predecessors in the last century, they've monopolized control of new forms of technology and industry, and they're using that control to drive previously unseen levels of inequality to make themselves the wealthiest, most powerful people in the world. And in order to hold on to that power, they're increasingly embracing the nationalist, militaristic, and authoritarian politics of Donald Trump. Beneath the power and wealth, the products these robber barons are creating could transform the world in profound ways, with significant implications for employment, climate change, democracy, and global power dynamics. Today, to discuss all of this, I'm joined by Sofia Scacera, a fellow of the Transnational Institute who is based in Argentina, and Anita Gurumurthy, who runs an NGO called IT for Change based in India. Sofia, Anita, welcome to London. Welcome to the podcast. You're both here for our conference, Tech Empires, which is going to take place this Saturday. That's already going to have happened by the time the podcast comes out. But maybe I can start by asking you both why you've traveled so far for this event, why you think this subject is so important now. Anita?
Tech and big tech seems like an unstoppable force today, controlling everything from core infrastructures and the economy to political narratives and even colonizing our most intimate spaces. And I do believe that if we don't come together as progressive actors, North and South, it might be too late. And this is really about recovering people's autonomy. We talk about sovereignty, but it's really about people's self-determination to collectively reshape technologies, reimagine technologies, and also define technological materialities. Do we want this big bang, everything, you know, biggest beautiful paradigm, or do we want it otherwise? This is not a task we can leave to big tech, and certainly not a task that we can leave to our governments even. It is for all of us to define, and that's why I'm here.
Brilliant. Thank you. Sophia?
Well, constructing what Anita was saying, maybe it's my trade union DNA, but the truth is that the labor force and civil society, we're only one. There's no countries, really. It's just people in the world with different cultures, with different realities. And we are against a superpower that is going around the globe. This is not something happening in Latin America or in the UK or in India or elsewhere or in the US or in China. It's happening everywhere. And if we don't unite, if we don't strategize together, if we don't brainstorm what the ideas would be around fighting back, about self-determination, like Anita was saying, if we don't try to imagine that another future is possible, then it really comes down to what an individual can do against a superpower, and we cannot afford that kind of thinking. We need solidarity, and that's why we are traveling here, and we are here this week to share thoughts, to share strategies, to try to think together, because that's our superpower. They do have a superpower, but we also have a superpower that is collective imagination. And I think that's the greatest power on earth, and that's how societies always constructed knowledge throughout time. And so it is important to keep that thought together. And that's why I'm here. That's why I crossed the Atlantic to be here.
Thank you. Well, I'm very grateful that you both have done and that you're both here. And I should say the conference at the weekend is one of the most popular that we've put on in recent times. Lots of people signed up immediately. And I think that speaks to something interesting that's going on in the world at the moment. I mean, these big tech giants have been very, very rich and powerful for a long time now. But within the last couple of years, with the development of AI, I guess, the level of fear, hostility, opposition, confusion that many people are feeling around this has made it really, you know, front page media issue, you know, nearly every day. Sophia, do you take some hope from that? I mean, what do you think is driving this hostility? Is it a kind of sci-fi fear of AI or something that really relates more concretely to people's lives?
I am a little bit biased because I'm always optimistic. But the truth is that 20 years ago, when all this mess started and we started to use smartphones and collecting, these companies started collecting data from us, nobody really cared about this, you know? And we, Anita, myself, we started working on digitalization and we started saying, hey, this is dangerous. And everybody looked at us like, hey, you weirdos, stop. What are you, technophobics or what, you know? And now that changed. That changed. I mean, the people are aware that this is a problem. And even if you never heard about Elon Musk, which I doubt, you know that your phone is spying on you and they know information about you, you know, these type of things. They're already in the mindset of people. People already know that the information they're getting on their cell phone might not be quite neutral and that they're trying to sell them stuff. And even if they didn't look for a product on the internet, it just suddenly shows up on their phone. So that's a ground that we won because we have been warning about this for a long time. I mean, not about that they're selling products, but about the fact that these people have information over you and therefore they have power over you. And that's a ground that we won. And I think in that sense, I am super hopeful for what is coming. Especially if we start listening to youth, if we start listening what the problems are of the young folks, because young people know the problems better than we do, we as millennials, but they don't have the political education. They never fought these powers. But the old generation already did fought. For instance, I'm coming from Latin America. We fought dictatorships. We fought the political powers, but we don't understand technology. So I think it's a really important moment in history where we have to build dialogue, intergenerational dialogue, because that's what it's going to be really fruitful in the struggle for the future. So I don't know if this brings hope, but I think we have the tools. We just need to learn how to use them, and we need to understand how this intergenerational dialogue can build power against these forces.
Brilliant. How do you feel about this from an Indian perspective, Anita? Because obviously the tech revolution, in a sense, has created a lot of middle-class jobs in India. Is there a difference, presumably, in how people feel about the current moment?
Well, you know, India is a country of contrasts. Obviously, some of the world's most powerful elite are from India. So big tech, of course, has been able to make a lot of inroads. They have kind of co-opted the infrastructural sovereignty narrative. In fact, on NVIDIA's blog, you will find that NVIDIA is proud to associate with Indians to build Indian apps on Indian soil. So the government is not only partnering with super chip firms like NVIDIA, but also with hyperscalers like Google and Microsoft, investing in this kind of multi-billion dollar data center projects. And of course, these investments are very important to India. Otherwise, there is this fear that between China and the US, India would be left behind. But what this also means is that tax holidays for 20 years. And that is really a fiscal opportunity cost in a country like India. It's also very clear that macroeconomically, you know, we are a very, very big market. And that is really, actually the attraction that India is, right? And today, the IT enabled services industry, the erstwhile BPO sector, is going away. And those jobs are gone. And there is this vacuum. And then people are asking, you know, what are you going to do with this kind of agentic AI? Are you going to use it for frontline workers? Are solutions going to be embedded, you know, in this kind of cutting edge of social development? And I would say that not all of this is a happy story. I quite appreciate your optimism, Sophia. But, you know, sometimes when disembedded technology comes, you know, into society, we do need public deliberation. And I do think that with statistics telling you that we have a youth bulge, unemployment is going up, we do really need careful consideration in respect of industrialization in the digital epoch that is cautious, careful, well-deliberated, and thoughtful around many forms of dispossession, not just labor, as Sophia pointed out, but also ecological. So we are in this kind of a flux, and I would think that a lot depends on the kind of counterpower that we all want to bring in.
Great, thank you. I mean, there's a debate, right, about whether the rise of the tech corporations, backed, of course, by the financial sector, represents something genuinely new in economic terms that we've not seen before. I introduced these people as the robber barons, right, comparing them clearly to the late 19th century Rockefellers and Vanderbilts and Carnegies and whatever. And I think they represent a standard form of monopoly power that we've seen before. But there are others who take a different view and say, you know, for example, Yanis Varoufakis talks about tech feudalism and that we're moving into some type of economy that we've not seen before and not seen for a very long time. What's your view on this? How much do you think it's a problem of monopoly capitalism? How much do you think it's the threat that these corporations pose to us because of their control of data and so on is something genuinely different?
Well, I think history has a funny way to that rhymes with itself, no? We have seen this throughout history a lot of times. History doesn't repeat itself, but it kind of rhymes, you know? I'm totally into the academic debate on whether this is techno-feudalism or techno, I don't know, whatever name you want to call it. But I think that mostly that debate is irrelevant. What it is relevant here, and what I want to point out, is that through data, these guys find a way to monetize things that weren't capable of being monetized. And human life, as we know it, the nature, your personal relationships, your, I don't know, your tastes, the conversations you got with your mother last week, or whatever you can come up with, these guys find a way to get money out of that. And that is something that never happened before, you know? We kind of got the feeling that there were things that they were your own, you know, your free time, enjoying the summertime, watching the sun, you know, I don't know. And now these guys find a way to get money out of that. It's incredible, but they did. And that's something that shifts the equation on how much information they got about you and therefore how much power. Because information builds technology and technology builds power. And this is not something new. This is something that we have seen since the humankind is humankind. I mean, in ancient times, the priest of the town had the information about when to harvest and when the crops came and when, and that was the technology, and therefore he had power. You know, that in Latin America it happened that. So always information tells you how to manage a technology, and therefore you are the most powerful in the society. And that's why they never want you to understand the technology. There is a political decision for people not to understand technology. It's the same barrier you get when you talk with a doctor and when you talk with a lawyer. They don't want you to understand their discipline because otherwise they lose power. And this is happening with technology, and it's getting harder and harder and harder to get there because of IP rules and because of many things, you know? And this is the difference that I think the main difference that I see here is that the power grab this time is really tremendous. And it's quite different from what we have seen in the past. Then we can start talking if this is feudalism or if it's capitalism or if it's... I don't think this adds up to public opinion. This is more like an academic debate that they love to have. What it does have, it is a difference, is that we are accustomed to see that corporations lobby our governments. We are accustomed to see that corporations put money into campaigns and lobby governments and all this kind of stuff. This is the first time that corporations are even more powerful than governments, like truly, really, and governments that tend to be super powerful. And governments rely on them to build even more power. And this is something we have never seen before. I think this is the main difference that should alarm us as a society and should move us to organize and strategize, because I don't want to say democracy is at stake, because I think it's a statement that is too strong. But the truth is that if we don't democratize technology, if we don't find a way to do that, it's going to be really problematic. And I don't know if this answers your question, but at least this is kind of like where I think we should be putting the eyes and not so much on a word that defines the historical moment.
But I thought that was really interesting when you talk about how it's marketizing bits of our lives that have never been marketized or monetized before. But of course, that is what capitalism does, especially when it enters a crisis. It needs to expand. Imperialism is one way it expands.
It's the frontiers.
Privatizing our, absolutely.
It moves the frontier.
Absolutely. And so the fact that our social relationships are now far more monetized and commercialized through this technology makes sense within the normal dynamics of capitalism, unless we stop it. And that's always the battle between democracy and capitalism, right?
I would agree. And I think that this is a continuation in this epoch of capitalism, but I think also not to forget that this is knowledge or cognitive capitalism on steroids. That's what you're trying to say, Sophia. And I do see parallels in history. In English history, the enclosure of the commons was really the turning point for capitalism. And now, as Sophia points out, what we see is an enclosure of social knowledge commons. It's really those little things that only your intimate self will know, or you believe only you know, suddenly pops up as a nudge on your screen. You know, how shocking can that be? And I think that this form of primitive accumulation is a kind of a new phenomenon, because the technology allows for that kind of interface. And it is based on similar principles of dispossession, you know, which involves ecological devastation, the kind of hollowing out of labor, and all of those things which are characteristic of capital accumulation and empire.
And it's having some really concrete effects, right? I mean, we've spoken this week already about the fact that some in this world are very obsessed with privacy and individual rights, right? And none of us are saying that's not important, of course, but it kind of misses the big point that what's happening here is a really big structural change in our economy that is affecting people in far more collective ways than simply our individual rights. And I mean, Anita, I was wondering if you could maybe give us some examples. I mean, what fascinated me is the Indian economy has been very strong at keeping out big Western supermarkets, the Carrefours and Tescos and so on, in order to support its own retailers and retail sector. Big tech is a way that some of these corporations are getting around those rules by selling directly online, right? If I'm understanding the Flipkart revolution and so on in India. So it's affecting all different bits of our economy, far, far, far more than just, you know, our individual privacy and rights online. The question is whether you have any examples of how structurally this is affecting the Indian economy beyond the privacy and,
Yeah. So one of the things that is important in a context like India is that even till about 25 years ago, there was a little bit of something for everybody to take away. So the idea of economic democracy was very ingrained in the way in which we thought as a socialist republic. In 1991, we liberalized the country. And subsequent to that, of course, in 10 years, we saw the advent of the internet revolution. There was a lot of hope pegged to all of this. But I think the kind of software elite of India were able to garner a lot of power, and eventually their partnerships and collaborations with the state has generated a new form of political collusion that has become completely apathetic to the way in which the country's challenges are faced by the most vulnerable. So in some sense, as Manuel Castells pointed out in his trilogy of the Information Society, The problem about what we are going through in this kind of digital capitalism is not really about exclusion or being pushed to the margins. It's really being rendered entirely irrelevant. So it's about expulsion. So what we actually see about pushcart vendors, despite the fact that India might have actually had the first of its kind innovation in terms of the universal payments interface, so that you can do away with paper currency, but you can actually pay through the internet, you know, through banking software that allows for secure transactions. Despite all of that, and despite the fact that a pushcart vendor might have a QR code through which you can pay, you don't really see an impact on the real economy. So the problem really is nobody knows in the kind of ascendance of this datafied society and Gen AI revolution, how all of this is going to come back and enable the small players to become stronger. And meanwhile, the unions are not even aware that platform work and platform-based managerial controls and the algorithms that are opaque are really at the heart of the problem. And on the other hand, the international, transnational companies are very happy to really transfer the burdens of all of this, of the erstwhile social contract, to the government. They won't even pay into a kitty for the purposes of, you know, a pension or some kind of social security. So this is really a moment when the given textbook of many things we took for granted in citizenship, in terms of welfare delivery, all of that is going through a change. Society in India is really now extremely techno-deterministic. The narrative has huge currency because India exports its talent. And therefore, we would really like, as a country, as a nation, as an official kind of a narrative, to keep that place. We don't know where we are in tomorrow's competitive economy. And therefore, this skewed narrative that we often hear pretty much hides the underbelly where there is, I think, a lot of friction, tension, real issues of marginality. In fact, I just put into Ngrams in Google the word poor and poverty. And you can actually see the graph go up all the way up until the year 2000. And then the graph falls because the books have stopped referring to the word poor or the word poverty. Talking about terminology, Sophia. This is shocking because we talk about the digital divide, but we don't really talk about systemic deprivation, institutionalized poverty. And that really concerns me because what we are doing is depoliticizing this technological narrative.
Building on what Anita is saying, I think in Latin America, what I'm seeing is that so there is a huge debate about the if labor relations should be liberalized or not, you know, if you should have a labor contract or not. And you see youth not wanting the first industrial and second industrial revolution rights, you know, that they were gained with a lot of blood and struggle. And they are like, no, I don't want to go to a job 8 hours a day, and I don't want to do this, and I don't want to do that, you know, especially the middle classes. And on the other side, you see the technological change, and you see platform workers, and you see this kind of new work. And one thing that struggles me is the fact that the technology allowed you to have a relative sovereignty of your time, you know, especially to the middle classes. And this was not claimed by the trade unions as a new labor right. This particular thing was not claimed by the trade unions as a new labor right. They were stuck in this industrial revolution labor rights. And that led the debate, especially the labor rights debate, to a closed corridor, you know, like an alley that they couldn't get out because youth was like, no, I gained this new labor right. I want to work through my phone. I want to do this. I want to do that. And the unions were like, no, that's illegal. You shouldn't be doing that, you know. And this lack of dialogue this lack of understanding what technology was bringing to the new generations, I think is what put the trade union movement in crisis, especially in Latin America. I can say speak. No, I don't know in other parts of the world. But it's something that put the trade union in crisis because youth didn't feel represented by the trade unions and therefore they didn't join the trade unions. And the trade unions did not collective bargaining over these new things. Now, I must say that that is changing in some places. And they're starting to collective bargaining around algorithmic management and AI and data. And that brings me hope because it's the new things that we need to answer to the youth. As millennials, as old generations, we need to give those answers. And I'm not saying that working 8 hours a day, it's old-fashioned. What I'm saying is we need to reshape the way we think about labor because otherwise we're going to see more and more people working on consultant contracts, part-time, you know, these type of things because youth accepts that because they want those rights. They want them. And this is the biggest problem we have over narratives on labor rights, that it's coming. And in that sense, adding what you were saying, Nick, about privacy and surveillance and all that, I see a lot of people, especially in Europe, worrying about privacy and surveillance, like if it's the only topic. And they do not care about collective rights, not individual rights, collective rights. No, my right to collective bargaining over what technology is going to be used over me, how they're going to be using it, if they're going to profile me, if they're going to do, I don't know, behavioral economics over me through algorithms, about the environment and how this affects the environment. They are not worried about the collective and the commons. And this is something that I think trade unions should be bring back to the debate, because otherwise we're stuck on privacy, surveillance, and all individual rights, who are okay, I'm not saying they're not, but the debate is so much more than that. And it's kind of problematic at some point, because if you only talk about privacy and surveillance, the reaction of the people changes through regions. In Europe, you are so concerned about that. In Latin America, whenever I talk about privacy, they look at me like, I don't care. It's great to lose my privacy. And you're like, why? Well, one time I was in a trade union, in a healthcare trade union. This story is amazing, I think. And a nurse, I was interviewing a nurse. And I was like, aren't you worried about the surveillance camera? And she looked at me and said, no, because that surveillance camera is my guarantee that doctors will not touch my butt while I'm working. So what I'm trying to work with them is saying, okay, so you're not worried about surveillance, but aren't you worried if you have access to that camera, if you have access to that information and you can use it to collective bargaining with your union over the rights of the nurses to have access to that information to denounce abuses? Do you have that right? Oh, no. Oh, maybe the union should be working on that then, you know? And this is kind of like the shift, how we take technology, how we democratize that technology, how we build power over that, how we take it out of the corporation's foresight and the corporation's power, and how we regain the power, gaining rights over how that technology is being used over us and how we can manage that technology in order to make it work for us. Some technology is going to be state-led, some technology is going to be corporate-led, some technology we can build and think about other infrastructure. The important thing is what right do we have over that technology and how we hold that technology accountable for our people.
Thank you. One question before we go to the break, and it's a big one, and you may have different takes on it, I think, as well, which is we talk a lot here in the UK and probably Europe as a whole about the Musks, the Zuckerbergs, the Bezoses, the American corporations. But of course, for many people in the world, their tech sector is dominated far more by Chinese corporations. And you've had a lot of thoughts on this, Sophia, and how the left is ignoring this question. Do you want to say from your perspective in Argentina, how you see this rivalry between US tech and Chinese tech. Does it give us an opportunity as movements, or is there a real threat in there?
Either technology, when it holds so much power, it's dangerous. I am not pro-Chinese or pro-US. I don't care. I don't want anyone to have that amount of power. That's why I'm talking about democratizing technology and taking over. So I don't want anyone to have that amount of power. Now, it is true that the struggle between China and the US could benefit us in the sense that if a superpower is in crisis, there's an opportunity to bring new forms of regulation and of accountability and everything that we need. So I think the movements need to strategize and be ready when that opportunity comes in order to shape different types of governance, especially worldwide governance over data and over technology and over algorithms. So I'm not saying, oh, yes, go China, destroy the US. No. What I'm saying is if there's a struggle, if they are fighting, if they are, and to be honest with you, I think they're totally different models. But if there is problems, we need to put that into our favor because we don't have a chance to lose. We can't afford losing a chance to put our agenda there and being able to democratize the new superpower, which is digital technologies.
Anita, would you agree? You see the way that the Chinese government and Chinese corporations work as quite different from the way that American corporations work. Am I right?
Yes, I do. And that's not because I do want to kind of be lenient in my analysis of the Chinese context. And I agree completely with you, Sophia, that what we're talking about is some kind of totalizing power. And that really leaves societies paralyzed, you know, and that leaves societies also very, very dependent. And their intergenerational kind of future imagination gets into this kind of, again, paralysis. What I think is that the way in which, in the absence of international rule of law systems for data and AI governance, US corporations have been behaving is really about what used to be part of science fiction imaginations about the killer switch. We have witnessed, in the context of war, exactly how every few months in the news, we actually see American corporations come out as guilty of, you know, the kinds of use of technology that are entirely unacceptable. I mean, just because we do not have an, you know, international cyber war or cybersecurity agreement, it shouldn't be that these autonomous weapons are or technologies weaponized in the context of mass-scale surveillance, which also promotes war. I do also think that in the absence of a framework of global competition law, because competition law is essentially national, right? It is usually competition authorities are meant to look at market forces nationally. But what has happened with American monopolies broadly is 9 out of 10 powerful companies in the stock market and in the AI scenario is American. And these are entirely responsible for a kind of bubble economy, right? We don't really know. People promise that in the next 10 years, 20 years, we're going to see differences in productivity because of all of this generative AI. My view is that a particular form of American political economy is creating a new form of empire. And I wouldn't think that there is in the kind of Trumpism a certain buffoonery or innocence, but the kind of ways by which the USTR has always operated only found an intensification of the kind of control they want to have over the rest of the world. But I think that beyond this binary, and indeed because of international cooperation, even China, through its aid and various roads, you know, Silk Road and this road and the other, is making way into African countries, you know, through its aid arrangements. And I think that that too is indicative of the kind of helplessness that many countries find themselves in. You've not been part of this value chain, So how do you get in there? You know, it's a big question. Everyone wants to digitize, so they're looking for digital ID programs, looking outside. Nobody wants to reinvent the wheel because you cannot reinvent the wheel, you know. So therefore, this kind of phenomenon places people in a Hobson's choice. So it seems like it's a choice between China and the US. However, I do think that beyond the binary, maybe other alternatives. In the combination of digital public goods and perhaps an encouragement of the commons. So some form of public goods can be provided. We do need a reform of the financial architecture. We need public finance. I think venture capital has seen its limits, and that's not going to redeem us. We do need public finance. And that kind of reform of the international financial architecture, which can support countries to build contextual and frugal AI, is really important so that people can determine where they want to go from here. The last thing I want to say is that the kind of power that the US is currently exercising in terms of the terror that they unleash and the collusions of horror, especially in situations of war in West Asia, I think is something very few countries have stood up to condemn. So when we recognize the power of corporations, we really have to look at the way in which political and economic power fuse to become one. And that, I think, is quite unprecedented. And that's where I'd really be worried.
Right, let's take a break there. When we come back, we'll talk about what demands we, the movement, should be putting forward at this moment, and in particular, where the digital sovereignty is a concept we should be pushing.
Hi there, I'm Nick Dearden from Global Justice Now, and I've got a small request. Counterpower isn't just about conversation, as great as that is. It's about turning ideas into action and building real community power. That's why we have a simple pledge to you, our audience. On every single episode, we'll leave you with something that you can do, big or small, to catalyze change. Whether it's the latest big ideas or the movements you need to check out, you'll find them on Counterpower. But to do all of this, we need your help to launch the project. We know it's got great promise, but to get it off the ground, we need your support. We're aiming to raise £8,000 to kick off this exciting project. To support our launch, please go to the crowdfunder linked in the show notes. And one more thing, whatever you do, don't forget to subscribe, like, and follow so that you never miss an episode. And if you like what you hear, leave us a review.
There's a disagreement in progressive movements or left-wing movements about how to respond to some of the technology that's now on the table. You know, some people say, well, the technology itself is neutral. It's who controls it and how we use it. Others say, actually, if you look at how this technology works, it embeds very, very problematic dynamics in society. What's your take on this, Sophia?
Well, I must say technology is not neutral, and this is a philosophical debate that it was solved really long ago. If you read philosophy, it's already solved. You know? Technology is not neutral. The intentions of the person who created it, the company who created it, are embedded in design. And this is something that it's like that, and we should be aware of that. And we live in a capitalist system, and therefore the objective is profit. And we should not be ashamed of saying it. It's the truth. Now, I understand people who are anti-tech because they see this and they're like, oh, we shouldn't be using tech, you know? But on the other side, whenever that happens, I totally support it. And I think it's okay if you are able to do it. But I think that not using tech, it's a luxury that rich countries can do, you know, because we need to solve development. We need to feed our populations. And this is something that I struggle with governments all the time in Latin America, whenever I talk with governments and whenever we try to find solutions. And the truth is that you cannot ask the consumer, because again, that's neoliberal. You cannot ask the consumer to take the responsibility for what it consumes. You know, like me as a consumer, I cannot be aware of where my dairy products come from and what type of technology I use and what type of energy I'm using and what, you know, like, it's too much. It is too much. Governments should take that responsibility to filter that and to regulate in order to make those objectives of technology worthwhile for your society. So I think it's okay if you have a responsible consuming of technology. I totally agree. And there's alternative technologies that are really good, and we should be using them. Actually, I'd use it. I use them. But it's not something that I ask for the population to do. I ask governments to take the responsibility of telling you if the water that you're drinking is safe, if the technology that you're using is safe. It's the same thing. It's exactly the same thing. Because otherwise, we forget how responsible governments are for this disaster, and we place the responsibility over people. And I do not like that. The responsibility is not of the people. The responsibility is of governments who let these corporations do whatever they wanted for 25 years or more. And now all of a sudden they want to regulate and they find themselves in problems because they are powerful. Oh, now you realize that? Come on, you know? And so we as citizens, yes, we do have the responsibility to ask our governments to do that. And in the meantime, you want to consume technologies that are good, which do exist. I am more than happy that you do so the same way that I'm more than happy if you take care of the environment or if you have responsible consuming over the food you eat, you know? Anyways, that's good, but it's not enough.
Yeah.
It is definitely not enough.
Yeah. I really liked, Anita, the term you used just before we had the break of frugal use of AI, which seems to me something that the government should be building in at the moment, given, at least as things stand at the moment, the amount of energy and resources being consumed by the AI revolution is just massive and something we can't afford. You've also been telling me about community-based AI systems and models that I knew nothing about before. So it sounds to me like you have some hope that used in the right way, with the right regulatory framework, there are positives here.
Absolutely. And I agree with Sophia on the fact that there hasn't been a civilizational moment where technology didn't interface with social relations. Of course, they were all different. You know, we do know of cave women who kind of carved out things with stones. And then, of course, then fast forward to the print revolution, and then here we are. I do, however, think that it is, Sophia, probably something we have to nuance about leaving the responsibilities to governments, because the nature of information technologies is such that anyone using it, as we agreed, will exercise power over society. Therefore, I do think that we don't have a counterfactual. We don't know what would have happened if the mobile phone hadn't happened. And therefore, while it is quite settled in philosophical senses that, you know, technology is not neutral, I do also think that particular technologies complicate social power relations in very, very particular ways. And therefore, I think that move fast, break things is now move fast, break things, break people, break the environment. And it's an endless loop of break everything. And at this point in time, we're all wondering how to put the genie back in the bottle. You know, that's an impossibility, right? Implausibility. And to that extent, I do think that where we are at is quite symbolic of, and it testifies to the fact that we never ever had a public debate about these things. People live on the edge because of precarity, but Elon Musk lives on the edge because he wants to live it up. There is a difference between both the edges. And I do think that privately endowed, bestowed technology, which is a largesse that Silicon Valley wants to do upon the world, has left us with no option for slow burn. It has really left us with no option to contemplate What is a kind of computational revolution? What is a kind of legal policy framework? What is a kind of social commons imagination that can coexist in order for us to have healthy technological consumption in the digital age? So I feel that the kind of enthusiasm we have about the statistical prowess of machine learning is up for questioning. I am certainly not going to say that it's not wizardry. Of course, it's wondrous. But I also don't know how the world would have been, you know, if we were to go by the counterfactual. And I just say this because I can see extraordinary harm. We have seen, you know, suicidal tendencies. We have seen society scale difficulties. People have compared this to drug culture, gun culture. And I do feel that the kind of opiate that this has become for the masses is a reality. Now, that is not really to become skeptical or Luddite or to reject technology in its entirety, but to ask the question, if we can't put the genie back in the bottle, then what can we do? And how can we redeem ourselves? Going back to the government in many countries in Asia at this point in time has proven to be disastrous. Content takedowns happen, and not just in the Global South, in the US as well, because companies are extremely happy to work with right-wing governments to just take down content. So many times this kind of course, we actually have to recover the state. You know, the state is important for the people. But I do think that the technological question is very much a question of public debate. It has to be put at the center. And in that regard, I do want to go back to your question on what would be frugal. I wouldn't want to err on the side of saying that for the poor, we need a different kind of alternative because they don't have the luxuries of using this kind of rapid, fast-scale technologies. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that there may be certain parts of the technological revolution that has to be provisioned as public goods, like the universal payment system, which is controlled by the Reserve Bank of India. This is an example I already gave. That's not for the people to design, certainly not, right? But it's the stability that we look to the state, you know, for a kind of economic, political kind of stability, that these public goods become important. However, in terms of applications and uses, I do think that the tools should be made available, but it's the commons. So it's quite possible that a small county or a small district in India or a small jurisdiction is able to develop its own app and use it in a manner that may or may not be federated or integrated with the next district or next county. That's very much a question for democracy, what you want to do or not do. So I think the problem is that we have too much centralization that prevents frugal technologies. The very same digital technologies, the techies will remind you, are also possible to build through a very different kind of imagination where the power is at the edges. And I think that that's very often forgotten, and huge amounts of money are spent for us to have social amnesia about that. I also want to say finally that it is because, for the very first time in history, individuals with extraordinary money that come from Silicon Valley have started influencing global discourse that we find ourselves so utterly flummoxed. This is the first time in human history that people are deciding whether to fund malaria or tuberculosis or something because they happen to make money in the stock markets because of the tech revolution. These are individuals who are absolutely frightening. And I think that unless we recognize that technology is in their hands and is in the image of their ideology, we're not going to be able to build frugal technologies.
So I think you've raised some really central points here to what we need to call for. That there is now a growing call in Britain and in other societies, particularly European countries, for a kind of digital sovereignty. And this stems from the fact that we have a president in the United States who is increasingly hostile to European countries. And heaven forbid this guy effectively has a kill switch on our military technology or our agricultural machinery or our medical technology, whatever. And by the way, you also don't want Xi or anybody else to have that kill switch. And so there's this growing call for digital sovereignty. But what that leads you towards potentially is a very centralized form of digital sovereignty, where countries like the UK, the European Union, begin building their own tech monopolies that allow the state to have unprecedented control over their populations. Sophia, you've thought a lot about this. What's the answer?
Well, I don't have an answer, but I can tell you that sovereignty is a word that is contested worldwide. But it's not something new. It's an old debate. What does actually mean? You know, the neo-developmentalists from Latin America in the middle 20th century questioned that. And they said, well, it's being able to manage your own dependency, you know. Maybe it's not the right answer. But what I'm saying is that this is not new. But it's something that it's putting us against the wall more and more all the time, because it is clear that sovereignty doesn't exist anymore. So when, even for the US, I mean, even for them, that they're the superpower, doesn't exist anymore, you know? They are managed by a couple of companies, by the technocrats, you know? You ask an American citizen whether they have power, and they don't know if they have actual power, you know? So it's kind of like, it's a complicated question. Now, what I do can tell is that there are different forms of sovereignty that we can still build. And those forms of sovereignty, it's building our own technologies, integrating with partners that are equal to ourselves to build new technologies when we need a scale-up technology, because we need to go big, and sometimes we don't need to go big. Sometimes we are able to stay small because we need different types of technology, like Anita was pointing out. So depends on the model you're going to follow. It's being strategic on how you choose your partner and how you choose ultimately your technological model. And that defines your sovereignty. But I think that sovereignty more than ever, is democratizing technology. And I'm going to go back to that all the time, because I think that's the answer. We need democracy in the technology, because it's a new superpower. We democratized the state because we thought it was too powerful. This is exactly the same. And so it doesn't matter which model are you following. It doesn't matter if you are going to go small or big. It doesn't really matter. The question here is how we build institutions that can hold technology accountable for our societies. How can we build regulation? How can we build? And ultimately also, how can we include institutions into the design of technology that will empower them? Because some people tell me, oh, but institutions are weak, Sophia. Like, how can you put an institute, like a trade union, being a social, a part of a society to build a digital public infrastructure? You know, how can you make a trade union own a part of the digital public infrastructure if they're weak? Well, if you include them, they're going to become strong, because they're going to have power. This is something that an idea that I built from the healthcare system in Argentina. So the healthcare system in Argentina, it's managed by the trade unions. We have a state healthcare system that it's basically for people who don't have a registered job, but everybody else has a trade union healthcare system. And that means that the healthcare system is managed by them with a solidarity point of view, because that's what trade unions do, but also gives them a huge amount of cash, you know, and a huge amount of power. Because when a trade union says, I don't like what you're saying, they are not just talking about a strike. They're talking also about healthcare. So this gives them a lot of strength. So what I mean by this is that when you get an institution and you put them on board inside an infrastructure that holds power, being a payment system, being a data center, being a cybersecurity, I don't care what it is, you're actually giving them power. So for instance, PIX, which is the payment system of Brazil, I think the banking trade union should be part of it, of PIX. Because if we leave it only for the government, then that's problematic on its own. So I don't care if it's big, if it's small. Sovereignty today means democracy. And democracy means having a system that will hold technology accountable and we hold technology to work for people. Because otherwise, we're just talking nonsense. We're just talking nonsense. At least that's what I think. You know, we need to go towards that direction, because otherwise sovereignty is an empty word where just doesn't matter what you're building. If you have a huge enterprise, if the intelligence behind that enterprise is managed by Amazon, then you're not sovereign, you know? Mm-hmm. So you need to be able to choose your allies, your partners, and how you're going to manage that technology in order to respond to people. Otherwise, I don't think we can really talk about sovereignty anymore.
Okay, let's take a break there. And when we come back, we're going to talk about how we can fight the tech giants.
Hello, my name is Elena Ivanova, and I am part of Another Europe is Possible's National Committee. Another Europe is Possible is a democratic movement owned by its members. We know that the political and economic systems we live in are failing people. And so we seek to transform them from below with solidarity in mind. We fight the global authoritarian turn and the climate crisis by building material links of solidarity with allies, movements and organizations across borders, because we know we are united in fighting these challenges. Another Europe is Possible believes in a real functioning democratic system that gives each one of us a voice. We see the threat from corporate takeover of institutions and the influence of dirty money across our politics. We also see the disillusion that this breeds in people and their turn to far-right populist explanations for the illnesses that plague our society. Our answer is solidarity, real democracy, transforming Europe from below. We believe in free movement for all, and we put forward the political arguments for it. We believe in votes that matter and that count for each one of us. We believe in working with allies across borders to face the challenges together. Another Europe is Possible was founded as a left-wing anti-Brexit campaign during the referendum. And now we are seeing the politics that we warned about rule. We're also seeing the Europe that we still want to have tight links to and a progressive bond with not facing up to the challenges of the day. We see our leaders here in the UK and European leaders across the continent bowing down to Donald Trump, to Netanyahu, to Putin, to the strong men of today. This is not the Europe we want. We want a transformed Europe. A transformed continent in a transformed world, built on solidarity, on justice for all. If you share our vision, then join us. Become a member of Another Europe is Possible. Take part in events, online and in person, in campaigns for migrants' rights, for more democracy, for a real democracy.
In preparation for the conference, I've been reading quite a bit about what's going on in the United States at the moment, where there are obviously far more data centers than anywhere else in the world. And the struggle against data centers in the United States is really quite inspirational at this point. There was a Time magazine article a few weeks ago which said the people versus AI, and it looked at these nine people from all across the United States who are struggling against data centers, from the right to the left, from nurses to people who've worked with Steve Bannon. One Democratic senator who's actually quite friendly towards big business said this issue could take more votes off Trump in the next election than ICE or Iran. That's kind of extraordinary. And it feels to me that we do have some power here over where this AI revolution is going, in that the infrastructure for this revolution is being built right now, and it's being built in the backyards of ordinary people here and across the world. And so in terms of some hope, that we can stop the corporate version of the AI revolution. It seems like the time is now. Anita, how do you feel about that? And how does it look from a Global South perspective? Because, you know, I suppose one of the fears is we stop something being built in London, but it just gets built in Morocco.
Precisely. I think, you know, we all understand, you know, with some basic comprehension of the economy, that all through modernity, we've been able to engage. Capitalism has been able to engage in labor arbitrage. Then there is energy arbitrage. So every time there is this kind of protest in the US and the news makes it big in terms of how communities came and stopped a data center, my heart misses a beat because you know for a fact that it's going to Morocco. And I think that in a world where power is exercised through the kind of deals that we've been making just so that we can live in this kind of a GDP competitive marketplace, this is not going to stop. And therefore, at some level, I think the question of sovereignty, Sophia, that you spoke about also has a very important, I would say, kernel of the right to opt out. The right to opt out is not quite the same as saying that, you know what, I'm going to go back to the dark ages and, you know, reject this technology. But I think the accountability dimensions that you've been talking about really need to translate in many, many ways to actual materialities and governance. For instance, if my biometric is really not readable by the machine and I'm an 85-year-old woman, then the possibility that I can opt out of the system in order to enjoy my entitlement, you know, is very important in social security. And similarly, how these accountabilities will translate in the context of the sovereignty that individuals enjoy in terms of their autonomous being and becoming is profoundly important, because it seems like our existence is entirely mediated by technology. And I think that's really not a good place to be, because that then puts to question, you know, this kind of inevitability, you know, and that I think is really an unhappy place. So coming back to the question of data centers and people's movements, I think that from all forms of electronic waste to other forms of landfills to ships that have been sent with waste to the Global South, what we are actually seeing in terms of this kind of arbitrage, you know, is not new. It's going to continue to happen. And it will happen on a scale that the Americans might really, you know, benefit from, you know, and unfortunately, maybe Trump won't lose an election because all of these things are going southward. And the story is really going to be how we are going to deal with this kind of large, big models and their huge power and the power of those individuals that I already pointed out to. It's really a question of reforming and coming to grips with the need for an entirely different international rules-based order. You have to make competition law an international law. I mean, we know from the UK to India to Latin America, we're really not able to deal with these companies because structurally, they are not registered, you know, in your jurisdiction. So you might, in your courts, say whatever you want about Google breaking up or whatever, but they will not, right? So even in terms of those behavioral conducts, there's always a way that they get by. And I think, therefore, that what's really important is to start by visibilizing the people and the places that are subjects of extraction. And these are beautiful maps that people have already built, maps with data centers of the world, you know, maps from where rare earth minerals are coming from. So you really need to visibilize. And that is really our job, because that visibility and politicization, making things legible, is really the challenge. And regardless of whether they are in Texas or in Hyderabad, I think these data centers owe something to the local community. And it's a part of the international political economic structures to question this kind of a biggest beautiful model. And I think that also bringing connections across movements would be a very, very important step. I think labor and environment and feminist and many others, you know, also progressive technologists. And that is the only thing that's going to save us.
Thank you. Sophia.
I don't know. You got me in that one. I don't think I want to add anything. Yeah. It's fine.
So this is an internationalist podcast, and we often see, we have an obsession in this country with what's going on in the United States, and know far, far less about what's happening in many parts of the world, particularly the global south. So I just want to come to you both and see if you can give us some insight into the state of struggle against the AI revolution, the tech giants, and it can be positive or negative, stopping data centers on the one hand, building an alternative form of AI on the other. And I guess built into this, you know, kind of the hope that you have for the next 10 years. Anita, can I come to you first?
I think.
Sophia, you want to go first?
Okay, so I think the governance issue is huge, in the sense that we have trade agreements building the architecture of impunity for big tech. We have seen a power like we described, like never seen before, on these big tech companies. I think that what I hold hope for is, and coming back to the first part of the podcast, is the fact that people are starting to be aware of the hazards and the dangers. New generations, sometimes people tell me, oh, they don't care. I don't see quite that. I see that there's a portion that doesn't care, but there was always a portion of youth who didn't care about politics. But there's other portion who are really worried about their jobs, their housing problems, the technology they're using, and all that. And that youth is growing, and we need to educate them in the political sense in order to tackle that, this, because the struggle that they're going to face is going to be huge. On the other side, I see that movements in Latin America, and I come from a country who is governed right now by the far right, okay? So there's not much hope in Argentina right now. When you talk with movements, they're like, oh, everything's lost. They're destroying our healthcare. They're destroying our education. They're destroying everything, that the scientific and technological system and everything. But the truth is that I see a youth that it's really moved politically. I see students holding on the universities, having classes on the streets to fight back Milei's plan and using technology in their favor. Actually, we have a streaming channel that is one of the most popular ones in Argentina that is totally progressive, and people see it. And when you see in every day the amount of people who are watching that channel against the far right, the progressive ones actually beat them. So you see a youth that is worried about what's going on. And on the other side, sometimes I kind of feel like everybody's like, oh, we're losing elections everywhere. The far right is winning in Europe. It's winning in the US. It's winning everywhere. In Latin America, that's not the case. In Latin America, we have Frente Amplio in Uruguay. We have Petro in Colombia. We have Claudia Sheinbaum in Brazil, in Mexico. We have Lula in Brazil. So it's not quite right, that analysis, when you talk in the region. And even though these governments are constrained and they're not doing as much as I would love to see, they are doing something. And actually, Brazil right now stopped the moratorium on customs duties at the WTO, which is a really technical name to say that data doesn't pay taxes on borders. And Brazil managed to stop it. Brazil also said no to Elon Musk a couple of years ago. So we should not forget that those struggles are taking place and that civil society is moving behind politics. And I don't hold hope for the state as an actor. What I do hold hope is on youth, on institutions, of movements, that they are starting to worry and they're starting to raise the agenda. And I think that is something important that we won. Because we want public, we are winning public opinion in this sense. People are worried about these issues. So we need to be out there recording podcasts, doing conferences, trying to talk to everybody, because we cannot afford to lose this battle. It's a moment of crisis in the system, and we need to be ready. And there are forces that are moving behind. And I see that in Latin America happen with feminist movement, with environmental movements, with political parties, with so many other movements that are really strong, with students' movements that are really worried about these issues, and that they're trying to build power, and they're actually doing things. They're doing stuff. They're doing streaming channels. They're trying to be on social media. They're trying to make good campaigns about different issues. They are trying. And they're succeeding. And I know they're succeeding because I see on the other side that they are worried. The big tech giants are worried. And that's why they're trying to pass free trade agreements, investment agreements. That's why they're trying to build the architecture of impunity worldwide, because they know that we can get them back. They know that we can actually do something to win this battle. And therefore, we should not be giving up. We should not be giving up. We should build more and more solidarity across the world, across movement. We should strategize. We should brainstorm. We should think, because we can get them back. And they are scared. They don't show on the media as if they are scared. They show the obsceneness of powerness. But they are actually scared, because otherwise they wouldn't care about the international trading system. They wouldn't care about international rules. I mean, if they have the power, if they can do whatever they want. No, they do care about that, because they know that states can get back. And so we need to regain that power. Again, democratizing technology, I think, is the solution that we need to brainstorm around and think worldwide. How do we do that locally, regionally, and internationally?
Thank you. And thank you for bringing up trade deals, which I work on and should have brought up myself. But I mean, this idea that they are using trade deals in order to cement their power in perpetuity, in exactly the way the pharmaceutical sector did in the 1990s, but I think with an even more far reach in terms of where this may go, it's terrifying, and we need to stop it. But I mean, I agree with you. There has not been a time in my lifetime, there's probably not been a time for more than 100 years since the richest corporate barons in the world were household names, and people hated them. This is a very unusual situation. And for me, there is most definitely hope in that situation. Anita.
I really loved listening to you, Sophia, in terms of the infectious hope that you bring. And it doesn't at all mean that I don't subscribe to it. Just coming from the Asian context, I think, to put it mildly, we've really had a very turbulent time. Just think about all the various kinds of formal democratic power that's been lost, from Sri Lanka to Bangladesh to Nepal. And one very, very beautiful thing about all of this is really it's the youth that dared to dream and network that actually resulted in the kind of questioning of statist authoritarianism in all these contexts. But Asia is also a very, very diverse kind of place. You know, you have both, I think, in terms of the political organization of society, also in terms of the development gaps. So you actually have Japan and South Korea and Singapore and all of those countries, with Bangladesh and India and others. And culturally, it's extremely diverse. It's a region, you know, that also is hugely populous. And I think in terms of the way in which the internet data platform AI paradigm has worked, it's not been a smooth ride at all. You know, we've seen what has happened in the Philippines, you know, dictatorships. And what all of that has done is it has shown many governments in the region how they could use technology for all the wrong reasons. So, you know, it is this kind of cross-learning that ought not to have happened. We really also have all forms of censorship in the Asian region. Again, going by statistics, we're really not very clear what's going to happen to the young people who were part of the BPO sector, because there was a huge dependence in terms of the call center economy on the Philippines, on India, on Bangladesh. Those jobs are gone or going. Of course, we say that even in the era of agentic AI, some of those will be needed because we need data labelers. And all those data labelers doing those, dehumanizing jobs are all coming from Asia. So it's a very mixed picture. You can see that adversity is the mother of democratic invention. And so people are rising. People are really asking questions. But I think it's a very hard time. You will recall that when Trump went to Malaysia, he actually managed to extract a promise from the Malaysian authorities that every free trade deal that the Malaysian government will sign would go through the US. I mean, that is really like it's farcical, you know. So, I mean, of course, later on it was seen to be a diplomatic blunder and, you know, they kind of tried to cover it up. But, you know, people were quite rattled and shocked by that kind of arm twisting that the US has managed to do. So I can also see that the power play in the Asian region between, you know, societies, countries that were not really friendly, you know, that is intensifying because of the interference of the US. And we cannot forget that Asia is the site of, you know, this kind of genocidal war. And I do feel technology does play a role, but there are wonderful organizations like Hamle, a Palestinian organization that has really asked for the right to use the internet really to support, you know, bottom-up movements. So what I do think is that I just love the way you described, you know, the thing about the rhyming of history, that kind of impulse in history to come back. And I feel this is really not forever, but I do think that the India that my daughters may be experiencing or what we are witness to is extremely different from the place that used to be when I was much younger. And I really have a lot of hope, as you say, Sophia, in the power of young people to redefine and also have a critical perspective about the very same technologies that censor them. So I think human agency is our hope, and therefore we wait and watch and choose the right side always.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the hope that you've brought. It's been such a pleasure to spend time with you today and this week. It's been great to have you here. That's all we've got time for today. I hope you've enjoyed the podcast. If you have, please leave us a like and maybe a review, and join us again next time.